Welcome to the Baptist Joint Committee podcast. I'm Jordan Edwards, Communications Associate at the BJC. Today, I'll be talking to Stan Hasty. Stan worked for the BJC for several years in the 1970s and 80s, and he is also the most recent recipient of the J.M. Dawson Religious Liberty Award, joining past winners like President Jimmy Carter, Susie Painter, and James M. Dunn. Stan, how are you doing today?
Doing well. Thank you, Jordan.
Now, first, Stan, I'd like to get some background on your work with the BJC. How did you first become acquainted with the BJC, and how did you first get involved working here?
I first heard of the Baptist Joint Committee when I was an undergraduate at Oklahoma Baptist in the early 1960s. I was a U.S. government major there, and I took two courses, related courses, first semester in history of the U.S. Constitution, and in the second half we did actual case law studies. And that's when I heard of the Baptist Joint Committee from teachers like James Ralph Scales and his wife Betty. And from there I went to Southern Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, ended up doing a PhD program, and one of my best teachers ever, Glenn Henson, suggested a dissertation topic on the history of the Baptist Joint Committee. And so I did that under his supervision and finished that degree in a couple of years, and well, three to be exact. It took a year to do the dissertation. So I came here January 1st in 1974 after writing that dissertation, without any promise of a job when I decided to take Dr. Henson's suggestion. But it whetted my appetite every day that I was going through original documents, correspondence of previous leaders.
Yeah, what was your initial role here at the BJC?
I was doing what you do, Jordan. I was the communications assistant. My boss then was a great guy named Barry Garrett, W. Barry Garrett, who was the first information officer, first full-time information officer of the BJC. I was his assistant and associate for the first 5 years that I was here. Then he retired and I was promoted, and then spent the next 10 years doing that job. But all of my time here was in communication.
And obviously, we report from the Capitol is still an important part of the BJC, but it was your main outlet for stories and for news coming out of Washington and Baptist life. Can you tell me a little bit about how you put Report from the Capitol together and how you went about writing your stories?
I was editor of Report from the Capitol relatively briefly, and it got a lot better when I passed the torch on to Victor Tupitsa, who did such a terrific job in upgrading the publication. But the Report from the Capitol had been around for quite a little while when I came here, and it was mainly a news sheet. We did not have legal counsel at that time. One of my colleagues, John Wesley Baker, John W. Baker, was the first attorney, but he did that while he was here. That is, he did law school out at American University at night. He was a political scientist before then. He had taught at the College of Worcester in Ohio, and that's where he came from, although he was a Texan originally. And John was a great guy, and when he took on law school and became the attorney, we began to realize how much more the Baptist Joint Committee could accomplish with expert legal counsel on staff. And thankfully, that's been an unbroken line since then. Before, we had that kind of more technical, in a sense more technical, but certainly content that was upgraded with a lot more legal knowledge than any of the rest of us had. It became a much better paper publication.
And the BJC became a more robust organization when John Baker joined the staff and became the first general counsel.
Absolutely, absolutely. We began to see in those days what the potential was for putting together coalitions. In those days, it was primarily coalitions around no establishment of religion. But over time, as you know very well, and as all who follow the Baptist Joint Committee know, the coalitions that were built had to do both with free exercise and no establishment. And it really helped shape the credibility of the Baptist Joint Committee into what it has become today.
Now, you were here when James M. Dunn took over in the early 80s.
That's right.
And can you describe what was it like working with James in that time period before the Equal Access Act in 1984, in the early 1980s during Reagan's first term? Can you kind of talk about that time period?
James came here the same month that Ronald Reagan was inaugurated for his first term, January of 1981. Reagan had campaigned as a candidate of the religious right, the Christian right, although it became quite clear early on that he did not have the intention of pushing for much of the agenda of the Christian right. The shorthand phrase that was used in those days was social agenda. That's how journalists came to label those issues. They had to do with prayer and other religious exercises in public schools. They had to do with tuition tax credits for parents who sent their children to parochial or sectarian schools at the elementary and secondary level. And it had to do with an anti-abortion plank in the platform of the Republican Party. But Reagan had big economic ideas and big foreign policy ideas that quickly superseded the rest of it. I won't say that Ronald Reagan ever became mainstream. He was definitely a figure from the right. But in terms of this rather narrowly put together social agenda that garnered him so much support from the Christian right, he never lived up to their expectations. James inherited not only a new president in the White House, but a growing storm, really a tempest in the life and the history of the Southern Baptist Convention. So he was fighting on two fronts, here in Washington and frankly in Nashville, where the power brokers of the Southern Baptist Convention gathered regularly to budget their funds and to receive reports from the heads of the various agencies. And it was clear immediately that James would be a thorn in the flesh on both counts, on both sides, both here in D.C. and in what were increasingly turbulent times in the SBC.
We could go on and on about the quote-unquote Baptist Wars and that sort of thing, but I really like to concentrate on James as a person. What was your first impression of him? Had you heard of him? You know, he had come from Texas. What was your first impression in meeting him and being his coworker?
He was a breath of fresh air. He came here to the Baptist Joint Committee at exactly the right time. We had had a good interim period, but we were all ready for a new leader, and we were actually at a Christmas party, I believe at John Baker's house, the night that we got the call that James, in fact, had been chosen and had accepted to become the new executive director. We cheered. He had made a wonderful impression on us on his visit here to the office. And then immediately he was the kind of leader that we knew was going to let us do our jobs. He was hands-on, but only to a point in terms of the inner workings of the office. He had plenty of things to do. And there are parts about James Dunn that a lot of people never learned because of he was so often a lightning rod. But he spent a part of every day writing notes, handwritten notes, to former students, to pastors and other people in church life, mainly to younger people that he had nourished in his years as a Baptist campus minister, and then at the Christian Life Commission of the Baptist General Convention of Texas. He had friends all over the place, most of them younger than he. He was a great encourager. And these handwritten notes on a card with with his distinctive handwriting and his expressions of concern for them, the keeping up with young couples and their families, their children, their graduate work. And then he soaked up news constantly and was in tune from the very beginning with what was going on in the larger Baptist scene. And he quickly made his mark here in D.C. too. People welcomed him, as you would expect. This office had by then gained a reputation as being the go-to place for religious liberty advice. It had become, I don't much like the word watchdog, but it had become the place where church-state issues were monitored most carefully. And the agenda had grown to that point that James, rather early on in his tenure here, began to focus the Baptist Joint Committee's attention entirely on religious liberty as an agenda. And what had been a larger, to use the phrase, the parlance that showed up in the original name of the Baptist Joint Committee, on public affairs. It was a public affairs agency. His predecessor, James E. Wood, Jr., who had also come here from Texas, from Baylor, had seen the agenda of the Baptist Joint Committee in much more expansive terms. But in part because of the fact that we had legal counsel and the election of Reagan as president and everything that was going on within the Christian right and more conservative Judaism in the country made it clear that there was plenty of specialized work for this agency to do in the field of church and state without pronouncing on other issues that, in fact, other shops were dealing with. In a way, we became more dependent on the work of other organizations, including, for example, the Friends Committee on National Legislation. That was the go-to shop for questions of military budgets and war and peace.
And their office is still right down the street.
Right down the street, that's right.
So let's back up just a little bit. When you accepted the J.M. Dawson Award at the board meeting, you briefly touched on the history of the BJC in terms of moving its offices and the early days. Can you kind of give a brief overview for the listeners about the BJC's early history?
Yes, Dr. Dawson came on board.
J.M. Dawson.
J.M. Dawson came on board. Joseph Martin Dawson came here from the pastorate of the First Baptist Church of Waco, Texas, the mother church of Texas Baptists, as it is known. He was already a distinguished pastor, a respected figure in Baptist life, and not just in the South, across the country. He had an intellectual curiosity that was boundless. When I was doing my history of the Baptist Joint Committee as a doctoral student at Southern Seminary, I had the wonderful opportunity of spending a day with him at the hotel in Corsicana, Texas, where he was living at age 94, living alone, but with a son nearby, an attorney who lived there in Corsicana. That's the reason he had chosen to move to Corsicana. But he was a widower by then, and his room was filled with books, and the television was on. He was keeping up with the news of the day. Just a most impressive figure. He came here in 1946, 10 years after the Baptist Joint Committee had gotten its start, but without the benefit of staffing. This was a joint conference committee, it was called at that time, of Baptist leaders from the American Baptist churches, or then known as the Northern Baptist Convention, the Southern Baptist Convention, and the original of the predominantly black Baptist conventions. To be sure, more tangentially involved, but still wanting to lend its name, the National Baptist Convention.
And this is before the formation of the Progressive National Baptist Convention.
That is correct. That is correct. And in fact, it was before the creation of the other National Baptist Convention. And interestingly, had not been very progressive in terms of its leadership on civil rights. And that's what gave rise to the Progressive National Baptist Convention. But Dr. Dawson was well respected nationally. And as the leaders of other Baptist communities began to know him And as the ecumenical community here in Washington began to know him, he became more and more influential. Interestingly, he told the BJC when he came that he would give 8 years. He was age 67 at the time, and he promised to work until 75 and then retire. And he did that. And he and Mrs. Dawson went back to Texas when he retired. But his leadership was exemplary. It was at a time in American political history when the Baptist influence was keenly felt. He came here when Harry Truman was president. He and Truman went to the same church for a while, First Baptist of Washington.
Which is the church that...
That I have belonged to for the last 34 years.
And there's prominently featured in the lobby area of the church is a photo of President Truman as... And there was another president who went there as well.
Jimmy Carter, that's right.
That was his home church as well, yeah.
And Harry Truman's pew is up there on the on the landing area of the second floor of the church in the old building. Truman and Dawson had an interesting relationship. It wasn't always harmonious. Mm-hmm. And that had to do with a fierce debate at the time over whether the U.S. should have diplomatic representation at the Vatican. That's a long story, too.
Yeah.
And that's a rabbit hole that would be interesting to go down. But... at any rate, Dawson was kind of a fearless person. In that sense, he was a good first executive for the BJC.
Now, what was Rufus Washington Weaver? What was his role in all of this?
Rufus Washington Weaver came to Washington from Mercer University to become the pastor of First Baptist Church of Washington. But 2 years into his pastorate, the District of Columbia Baptist Convention asked him to become its executive secretary, three blocks up the street. But he is the one who coordinated in his office the Joint Conference Committee. Rufus Washington Weaver became the de facto coordinator of the Joint Conference Committee, consisting of representatives from those three original groups that formed what became 10 years later the Baptist Joint Committee on Public Affairs. And it was 10 years into that informal period of time that the need was such that this joint conference committee decided to bring Dr. Dawson here to open an office. He hired a secretary, and for a number of years, for the time that he was here, in fact, the 8 years that he was here, that was the staff of the Baptist Joint Committee. They had an office on H Street, and then the office moved down to the D.C. Baptist Convention building. The D.C. Convention bought an old house on 16th Street, and that's where the office was until the move was made here to Capitol Hill. Dawson was a truly great man, a visionary person.
What was he like to talk to? You spent that day with him.
He's a gentle soul, extremely curious about world affairs, well-informed.
And he's a pretty sharp guy at 94.
Sharp at 94, sharp as he could be. One of those people who had the blessing of having his full faculties until the very end. He was short of stature, medium height, I would say, at most, thin, but had a mind that was like a sponge. And he was known for this in Baptist life already, and I'm sure that's one of the main qualities that drew him here and that drew the committee that looked for a first executive director to go to him.
Now, you've met James Dawson, and you worked with James E. Wood and James Dunn, you know Brent Walker. Did you have any interaction with Emmanuel Carlson?
I did.
And Emmanuel Carlson was the executive director mostly in the 1960s, correct?
He began in 1954.
54 right. And through 70?
Through 71.
71.
That's right, yeah. The reason I know that so well is that's where my doctoral dissertation ended, was at the conclusion of his administration here, yeah. He was a Swedish Baptist, came from the Baptist General Conference. He was the dean of that Baptist group's college, Bethel College. Mm-hmm.
which is where we just had the most recent edition of the Sheridan Lectures, was at Bethel. It's Bethel University now.
Yes, it's Bethel University. That's right. Yeah, Bethel College played an important role at that stage of the Baptist Joint Committee life. Dawson's tenure had been fraught with conflict, not within Baptist ranks, I don't mean that at all, but mainly with the White House. He had become a lightning rod and at times was brutally criticized for his criticism of President Truman's position on the question of an ambassadorship to the Vatican, which Truman eventually got through over the not only the protests of Baptists, but of the entire Protestant community. It was a united opposition. And in fact, Dawson was one of those who, a year after he got here, put together what was seen as a legal arm of the church-state cause with a group now known as Americans United for Separation of Church and State, Americans United for shorthand. But its original name was Protestants and Other Americans United, POAU. And it was combative. It was a legal shop. It was set up specifically to do battle with President Truman over this question. It became something of a hot potato issue, even among Baptists. And to have the president,
Truman a Baptist,
Truman and Dawson attending the same church. That is until Truman stopped going, and that too had to do with a sermon that was preached by the then pastor of that church, Edward Hughes Pruden, who preached a sermon one day in which he took the president to task. The president was there and didn't like it at all, and stopped coming to church because of it. The two of them went through a process of reconciliation, it should be said, and they ended up on good terms. But it was a tense time here in Washington over a question that now seems almost quaint. That period of history and Carlson's assuming the executive directorship here marked really an end to that confrontational aspect of the Baptist Joint Committee on one issue after another. Carlson was an educator, a professor and a dean, and he began to surround himself with people, including a research director named Wally Peterson was his name. He came here from Washington State University. And he was a Baptist, a lifelong Baptist. And the Dawson years were marked by in-depth research. And the report from the Capitol began to reflect that with thoughtful columns on a variety of
It was almost like
divisions.
An academic journal or something.
It became almost an academic journal, that's right. Mm-hmm. He was here 17 years, by the way, twice as long as Dawson had been executive director. He too was a gentle soul. I met him several times. I interviewed him, spent the better part of a day with him after the day I spent with Dawson in Corsicana. Learned all kinds of things about that period of time. That was the time when the staff began to expand, became more than a two-person shop. The Baptist Joint Committee entered into an agreement with the Executive Committee of the Southern Baptist Convention to set up a Washington Bureau for Baptist Press out of the office of the Baptist Joint Committee. And so Barry became the first, not only the first information officer of the Baptist Joint Committee, but the first bureau chief in Washington for the Baptist Press news service.
So I guess there was a point where the BJC almost felt like a newsroom, like a newspaper newsroom.
Well, a part of it was a newsroom, and some of those generating news were our colleagues here and how they interacted with the other people we were covering. By the time I got here, it was still the information section. It was still a two-person operation. But by then, not only did we have accreditation with the press galleries here in the Congress, but we had accreditation at the Supreme Court press room, and Barry worked hard to get to the Baptist Press a press card down at the White House. He became the first White House correspondent for Baptist Press.
Stan, you started here in 1974, which was an interesting time. You had Vietnam winding down and Nixon as president. Can you tell me a little bit about the atmosphere here on Capitol Hill when you arrived at the BJC?
It was tense. 1974 was a really tense year for the country as a whole, and we felt it every day. We read these two young reporters, Woodward and Bernstein, at the Washington Post. We saw their stories coming out day after day, page one pieces, as the Nixon presidency began to unravel. And I had been here only 8 months when he had to resign or face impeachment. That was the choice that he was faced with. The whole country, the entire news cycle every day was dominated by Watergate, and everything else took a back seat. Nevertheless, the work here at the Baptist Joint Committee on church-state work proceeded unabated.
Supreme Court was still functioning. Yeah,
that's exactly right. And Congress was still considering legislation that affected church-state relations all across the country at every level of life, from public schools all the way to religious exercises in Congress. So it was an exciting time in that sense. It was a time fraught with danger for the country. Mm-hmm. We were in uncharted waters at that moment with what was happening to the Nixon administration. But that was not what we were about here. We kept informed, and we had a lively interest in whatever the administration was doing with respect to church and state. That work did continue unabated in spite of the bigger story that dominated daily life here.
I want to jump ahead just a little bit. Well, actually, quite a bit, about 10 years. The two main pieces of legislation that James Dunn is known for during his tenure at the BJC is the Equal Access Act and, of course, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was enacted in 1983, which was a little bit over halfway through his tenure. Can you talk about how that came together, what your take as a communications staff member here was during that time period?
We learned a new cast of characters because of the legal work that was going on here. That was the time when Buzz Thomas, Oliver Thomas, known to us and I guess to everybody as Buzz Thomas, began to gather here in his office a group of mainly younger attorneys, not altogether younger guys, but men and women who were coming from different places along the ideological spectrum and certainly along the church-state spectrum. It was fascinating to watch him pull that coalition together, and then he and Brent were working together at it when Brent came to join him as the associate general counsel.
So those kind of relationships started with the Equal Access Act and continued through the 90s.
These young Turks here at the Baptist Joint Committee, brilliant young attorneys, pulled together a coalition of legal minds that ranged the whole spectrum, the Christian Legal Society on the right to the ACLU on the left. And I absolutely marveled at what they accomplished. Those of us who had been around a while were a bit startled initially that this was possible, that common cause could be found for this particular cause. But what it amounted to was a recommitment from the Baptist Joint Committee staff to the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment, to give it its equal weight with the No Establishment Clause, which had dominated what we did here in this shop for all the years before that. They did their work so well that on the day the Senate voted to approve, overwhelmingly approved, the Equal Access Act, I was with a whole army of journalists over there in one of those ornate caucus rooms just off the floor of the Senate, where some of the principal players were gathering for impromptu news conferences. Immediately after the vote, I remember being in the corner of one of those rooms with Jerry Falwell and other media colleagues, television, radio, and print journalists, interviewing him. And that was the day when Falwell declared that the passage of the Equal Access Act made unnecessary prayer amendments to the Constitution. It didn't take him long to renege on that, but he was on the record that day as having said, the Equal Access Act is much more significant to religious freedom in this country than any prayer amendment could have been. And it is a law that has stood the test of time. Then, a decade later, they brought together, as I mentioned a moment ago, not only the same legal minds, but others who had come along, put together that coalition necessary to write and then see passed and enacted into law, this time by President Clinton. The Equal Access Act had been signed by Ronald Reagan. But the same team expanded, doing equally innovative and good work based on that earlier coalition to tackle a whole new set of issues created by a terrible decision of the Supreme Court that needed to be addressed and that was addressed through this statute.
And that terrible decision was the Smith decision, which basically gutted the free exercise clause.
Again, a case that brought people together to seek a remedy that one would not expect to see around the same table. But there was almost overnight the instantaneous realization that the full implications of the Smith decision could indeed portend at least a partial death of the free exercise clause. So this coalition did extraordinary work. They took their time because it needed to be done right. And then, of course, it was challenged after that. But the core of that concept has lived on and has done great good for the country.
So, Stan, you worked here until 87, is that right?
89.
And you went and did your work with the Alliance of Baptists.
Right.
So why don't you tell us about that transitioning from the BJC to the Alliance?
I was covering the conflict in the Southern Baptist Convention, as all of us in the Baptist Press Network were. And I was covering developments here in Washington that had to do with the agenda of the new crowd that was in the process of taking over the SBC. That began in 1989, at least in a structural sense. I began at the Alliance on January 1st, 1989, and immediately the Alliance of Baptists found common cause with the Baptist Joint Committee. That's not the reason I was brought on. It didn't hurt at all that I had been a spokesperson for the Baptist Joint Committee.
And in those days, when you joined Alliance, you were the executive director?
That's correct. That was the title.
And and what kind of structure do they have in terms of office space and staff at that time?
There were only two of us at the beginning. After I was elected to the position, I invited Jeanette Holt, who was James Dunn's assistant and front office person here, to join me. We set up shop in a small suite of offices downtown in the First Baptist Church of Washington. And that's where we were based for the next 20 years plus until my retirement in 2009, at which time the Alliance became, in terms of its officing, became a virtual office and has continued to do extraordinary work. But yes, we came, and Jeanette and I moved from here to the Alliance at a time that the Baptist Joint Committee was under frontal attack. The dismantling of the Baptist Joint Committee, in fact, was one of the top priorities of the Pressler-Patterson group that ended up taking over the Southern Baptist Convention in rather short order, within a decade, in fact, just as they had threatened and then promised to do. Part of that painful process was the removal of funding, bit by bit, from the Baptist Joint Committee until the Southern Baptist Convention formally withdrew. And with that took its money. And the Alliance, as the first fragment, to use Bill Leonard's phrase, the first fragment to fall off of the Southern Baptist Convention, we became a small shop where the cause of the Baptist Joint Committee, its future funding, became of primary interest, along with the purging of seminary faculties around the country. All six of them felt the pressure of the new crowd in charge. But most especially and early on, Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary in Wake Forest, North Carolina, and Southern Baptist Theological in Louisville, Kentucky.
Which is where Brent Walker went.
Yes.
And several other people, Molly Marshall.
Yes.
It was a professor there. Bill Leonard was a professor there.
That's right.
So there was a deep connection with Southern and the BJC at that time.
That is correct.
Yeah.
And then four years after the Alliance got started, the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship came into being. And we didn't merge, but we ended up with an amicable division of labor. The CBF immediately began to grow much more quickly than the Alliance had. We paid a price for being the first group. And were marked as radicals by some. And in a way, at the time, that was not an unfair characterization, but it's one we chafed under a bit, and we made a good faith effort to merge our efforts with those of CBF. Institutionally, the merger didn't work, but in terms of the division of labor, it did, and it redounded immediately to the good of the Baptist Joint Committee.
Well, and you see today there's dozens of churches duly aligned with CBF and
the Alliance.
And the Alliance,
that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
In terms of funding, we had a lean couple of years here at the Baptist Joint Committee when the SBC formally withdrew and took its money with it. But quickly, very quickly, that money was made up and more.
Brent has told me this before about how much credit James deserves,
yes,
of keeping the BJC together.
That's right. And a big part of that had to do with the fact that the fundamentalist crowd never managed to take control of the Baptist General Convention of Texas. And the other state convention, or in this case, an association, the Baptist General Association of Virginia, resisted that takeover as well. Those were the two places that, in an institutional sense, were able to fend off those who had put together the takeover movement at the national level, the SBC level. It's another reason that James Dunn's election was inspired, and I believe providential. He came here, as I said a while ago, at exactly the right moment, not only in national life, but in denominational life. He was the kind of guy who wasn't afraid. In fact, he was fearless, but he also knew how to bring people together. And he made a strong case for the Baptist Joint Committee. I don't think anyone else on the scene at the time could have done what he did, and secured the funding of the Baptist Joint Committee from this diversity of sources. He also challenged all of the rest of us to up the ante as well, to redouble our commitment. And for example, one of the results of that was a re-energizing of the commitment of the American Baptist churches to the Baptist Joint Committee and its cause. That group became more involved than ever. Its key leaders became more committed than ever, I would say, to the Baptist Joint Committee, including the funding of the Baptist Joint Committee, so that the fact that Texas Baptist stood up, that Virginia Baptist stood up, that Kentucky and North Carolina Baptist stood up through their foundations to support the Baptist Joint Committee, this inspired others of the smaller groups to reinvest themselves as well. So that, sitting around the table the other day at the most recent board meeting here in this building, board meeting of the Baptist Joint Committee, to see all of those faces, most of them new to me, of people full of energy, full of passion for the cause of religious freedom, simply reinforced to me, underscored, all of this history that goes back now 80 years of people who were forward-thinking, who were always, in terms of Baptist life, they were expansive in their vision of what could be, especially in the defense and the promulgation of this priceless principle of religious freedom that has characterized Baptists in this country from the very earliest days of this republic. And to make common cause that way and to see the vitality, present-day vitality, of the Baptist Joint Committee, I think should inspire all of us and result in a renewal of our commitment, financial included, to this organization, which, like no other group that has ever been present here in Washington or anywhere else, has rallied to the defense of religious freedom, and not only for our people in this country, but has inspired people around the world and has energized and empowered Baptists around the world, even in places where they are small minorities, to speak with an outsized voice to the need for the protection of conscience, for the honoring of conscience. I mean, that's where it all begins in a theological sense. for us Baptists. That's what Roger Williams was about in Rhode Island, there in the very beginning. The cause of conscience, that's what this has always been about, and that is the priceless contribution of Baptists to the life of this nation and over the course of the past generation, emerging nations around the world who have taken the very language from our First Amendment, in many cases incorporated it into their own founding documents, and older democracies as well. Even in a place like Britain, where more and more the theme of separation of church and state is sounded. This organization, this agency, limited in size of staff and budget, has made a truly outsized contribution to the cause of conscience, to use Roger Williams' old phrase, all around the world. I think it's a most inspirational story.
I agree. And you have stayed connected to the BJC since your retirement. You're a monthly donor. Why do you maintain such a strong connection to the BJC? You still live in the Washington area. Why do you still maintain this relationship?
Simply because I want to do my small part. We learned in the great financial crisis that we all faced, beginning in the mid to late 80s, that it was going to take all of us pitching in. And that meant more than just giving a check to the church every week and for that magical distribution of the cooperative program in Southern Baptist life for those monies to make their way here to the Baptist Joint Committee. It required all of us at an institutional level, whether it be in CBF, the Alliance, State Baptist Conventions,
ABC,
the other Baptist bodies that comprise the Baptist Joint Committee, ABC included, yes. It caused all of us to re-examine our commitment. And on a personal level, that's something else that James did so effectively. He challenged all of us to step up and give what we could.
I want to touch on a couple more things before you leave here. You accepted the J.M. Dawson Religious Liberty Award in September. You joined people like Jimmy Carter and Gardner Taylor and Susie Painter more recently. What does it mean to you to be in that conversation as a Dawson Award recipient with those people?
I was genuinely humbled. This was utterly unexpected. I never even thought about it. And to receive that recognition for the work I've done as a communicator and in my subsequent role as the leader of one of these small emerging groups of Baptists that have made such a difference on the Baptist landscape over the last generation, I felt honored for the Alliance that I would be chosen for this recognition. And it means the world to me. Again, something I never thought of. My name does not deserve to be mentioned in that company. I mean, these are people who have shaped denominational and national life in a much larger way than I have. This recognition has made me realize that even in my older age, that I have something to contribute, hopefully, as a spokesperson for religious freedom. I'm moving to Florida soon with my wife Betty, and we're moving there to be near our daughter, who is a middle school principal in the Palm Beach County school system. I remember one of my best assignments as a staff member here at Baptist Joint Committee was to go to Fort Lauderdale to speak at a Jewish synagogue on what we have in common in the history of this country with Jewish people. And that goes all the way back to Roger Williams. And to see, as a young journalist, to see those people in a synagogue setting, to see their eyes sparkle at the idea that Baptists and Jews made common cause in the beginning of this country in seeking, in fighting for, and in seeing through that battle for the enactment of religious freedom as a founding principle in the documents of this country, in the Constitution, the First Amendment, the first 16 words of the First Amendment, to protect that right that we all cherish, no matter what religious body we may come from. And it helped me in an existential, a very personal way, to realize how important that common cause is with Jews and Muslims and people of all religious faiths or of no faith in this country. How utterly foundational this principle of free exercise and the no establishment of religion, these twin pillars that comprise our religious freedom in this country. I hope to be able to continue as a supporter of the Baptist Joint Committee for sure.
You recently spent some time as interim pastor at First Baptist Church of D.C.
Interim preaching minister, that's right.
Exactly. So yes. What was that experience like? You said it was a nice cap on your career.
That's right. Yeah, I spent 35 years in Washington working for two organizations, the Baptist Joint Committee and the Alliance of Baptists. My membership at First Baptist dates back to the 1980s. And in a sensitive time in that old church's history, First Baptist of Washington is one of the first congregations founded here in the year 1802, before Washington really was much of a town, let alone a city. To be asked by my fellow members to fill the pulpit, as it were, to undertake the preaching task for 2.5 years in a time of intentional self-examination, when we needed to do some remedial work in recommitting ourselves to some foundational principles in our own fellowship, to be asked to do that and then to see that through to the calling of a wonderful new pastor, Julie Pennington Russell, who's been with us now 9 months, well, a little longer than 9 months now, but making such a difference in helping revitalize that old church here. So yes, at the end of my career, to find myself once again invested in the ministry of the local church was intensely rewarding at any number of levels. I loved it, loved every minute of it.
Well, Stan, thank you so much for joining me for this podcast, and good luck in Florida. I hope you enjoy the weather and being closer to your daughter.
Thank you, Jordan. Thanks so very much for this chance to speak to something that obviously has shaped my life in so many ways. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for listening to the Baptist Joint Committee podcast. For more podcasts, go to our podcast page at bjconline.org/podcasts or subscribe to our iTunes channel.